Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and when he stated was the previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I got to tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we got to do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment.
And you know, I'm Carol Jurgensen, a.k.a. Carol's Coach, and we are big believers here at AppSats.org that the only way you're going to feel safe is by getting that disclosure. But before you get a disclosure, your husband or the sex addict needs to be in good recovery. So, you know, unfortunately, this kind of stuff, wow, it has steps. And it is hard. It's really hard for you to wait on wanting to feel safe because, of course, you want to feel safe right away. And we understand that. And yet we've got a method here. And it's what we have certifiably found to be what works the best for partners and for addicts, and for the coupleship. So one of the things that I love about this work is that I see so many couples heal when you never would have thought that it was possible to heal. And this show is all about letting you know that it's okay to trust your gut again. You know, when all this came out, you stopped trusting your gut. And even today's show, we're going to be talking about what happens when you are with a helping professional. Maybe it's a doctor, maybe it's a clinician, maybe it's a pastor, a leader in your church, and they just aren't saying the right things. You know, maybe you're feeling blamed for the addict's addiction. Maybe they're trying to tell you that you had something to do with it. Now, I know this is going to feel very disjointed if you're a clinician, a therapist, a doctor, a psychologist listening to this show, because I'm here to tell any of our professionals out there that the partner is never, ever to be blamed for her husband's sexual addiction. Never. I'm not saying that there aren't problems in the marriage. I'm not saying that she hasn't contributed to some of the problems. Because let's face it, guys, if you're like me, and I've been married 18 years, if you're like me, you know when you're contributing to the problem. In marital therapy and in my own marriage, I always say, am I contributing to my marriage right now, or am I contaminating it? I think we women can tend to be bossy, and we can tend to want it to be done our way. And I own that, at least. And my experience is I see that in our gender. That's something that I want to work on, because I don't want to do that to my husband. I want us to, you know, be equal, or at least sometimes I say you can't necessarily be equal, but some of the time I get what I want and some of the time he gets what he wants, and we both choose to pick our own battles and move on. John Gottman, a marital therapist and researcher, says 85% of all disagreements in a marriage are never really worked out. Okay, that being said, I also want to say to you that, and to any professional that's listening, those things are going on. Maybe people aren't having enough sex. Maybe the relationship's too sexualized. Maybe there's not enough give and take in terms of division of duties. But at the same time, a man's choice to, well, it's not even a choice, I'll take that back. A man's sexual addiction is based solely on the behaviors that he has exhibited and that have occurred over periods of months, years, and perhaps even decades. You see, what we know to be true is that the first recovery task that a sex addict needs to break is that he needs to know that he's in denial, that this is a problem, that he can't cure it, he can't fix it. He has to be able to use the tools that we talk about so oftentimes on this show. Can't do it by himself. And the other thing we know is that the second recovery task is that he has to understand about his sexual addiction. He has to understand that it's a brain disorder. And this is where I think the wife gets involved, the partner. She's got to understand that too. So even though he's participating in this horribly offensive, terrible, destructive betrayal, he also can't help it. Until he knows what the tools are, and, you know, he is not going to be able to stop it on his own. And so when you end up feeling rejected and not pretty enough or not good enough or not sexual enough, you know, the whatever enough, then what I want you to know is that this isn't about you not being enough. This is about him having an addiction. And that is not about you at all. It totally affects you, no doubt. But it is not about you. It's not because of you. And so when a pastor at the church hears about the betrayal for the first, second, or third time, and he says, you know, I'm wondering how much sex you're having. Could you bump that up a little bit? Maybe he'd be a little more satisfied. That's a horrendous betrayal. That's a spiritual betrayal. Or when a counselor says, well, you know, if you just appreciated your husband a little bit more, you probably wouldn't have to go outside of the marriage. That is a therapeutic betrayal. And unfortunately, there aren't enough people that know how to handle this epidemic called sexual addiction or problematic compulsive sexual behavior. So that's what we're doing at APSATS. We're training people. We're training people how to treat partners. We're training people how to work with couples. And it is solely our mission based on partner trauma. So, you know, there are other organizations that have developed because they wanted to help the sex addict. Well, we are an organization that want to help the partner, and we're willing to do what it takes to help the addict, to help the coupleship, and to repair the relationship if you are married, if you stayed married, if you aren't separated, if you aren't divorced. So, I often talk about what does it take to heal a sex addict? And clearly, what it takes is connection. And when I say connection, I believe that connection is the antidote for sexual addiction recovery. And then I believe that what happens in the meetings, what happens in group therapy, also happens in the marriage. So it's always a good thing when men are learning how to be more vulnerable in their 12-step meetings. A great thing, as a matter of fact. And I said earlier, we're here to help you restore your sense of intuition. Because I know you've heard me say before that we make decisions based on what we think intellectually, using our heads, how we feel, which is our emotions, using our hearts, and what we know intuitively. A lot of people say that's the spiritual side, what that judgment is. And when trauma has occurred, and when discovery has happened, or when the addict repeatedly slips or relapses, it can get you to doubt yourself. And so we don't want that to happen. We want you to be able to de-stress, deal with the trauma, and then repair yourself enough that you can begin to believe in yourself again and make better decisions. Now, today I have Michelle Burkett on, and she is with Hope Redefined on the show to continue the conversation about what the church can do to spouses who have been impacted by sexual betrayal. And she's going to be talking about that, and then I'm going to be comparing that to what I believe professionals can do to help with sexual betrayal. Because ultimately, the same things happen in all those areas, whether it's a friend, whether it's family, whether it's leaders in the church, pastors, priests, rabbis, therapists, psychologists, MDs, psychiatrists. They don't know what they don't know. And so Michelle put together this incredible do's and don'ts list, and that's what we're talking about today. She actually passes it out to leaders in the church and helps them to understand how they can at least respond when somebody shares how difficult it has been for them because they've been through sexual betrayal. So, Michelle, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, this is just such an important topic because the one thing we want to do is when a woman has been betrayed by her husband, the last thing we want to do is send her to get support and then have a second or third betrayal occur. So would you share a little bit with our listening audience about what you do, how you got started, and this incredible do's and don't list?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I have spent the last 6 years serving Christian women as they've stepped into their own healing and recovery journey. I'm the founder of a ministry called Hope Redefined, and we're based out of Knoxville, but most of our work is done online. And we offer online support groups, one-on-one coaching, and intensive spiritual healing retreats, which we offer 2 times a year. And then, as you spoke to, community education. And so Hope Redefined, honestly, was really birthed from my own story. My husband and I have been on the road to recovery now for 14 years. And after weathering a good portion of my story with little community and finding the majority of my support in books, God really invited me to become safe community that I had been yearning for. And I could offer an incredibly detailed history of how we came to be, but ultimately it was birthed from my own need. And I've been walking with women in their own recovery stories, like I said, for the last 6 years. So and I just continue to see the need for ongoing support, more intentional space to process, and one-on-one support. So with some fear and trembling, like I said yes to what God was asking of me, and we launched Hope Redefined in June of this past year. But it's really offered me the opportunity, as we've morphed into a nonprofit, is to have a larger voice for partners in the church. And it's been really a gift, honestly, to be able to find myself sitting with young adult pastors, marriage and family pastors, senior pastors, care pastors, women's directors, all these different places that ministry is taking place, and being able to help educate them on the needs of both parties that are affected by this sexual betrayal. And so I've had the privilege of offering them the education and knowledge they need to walk with their partners more effectively and offer them the resource to refer a partner out for appropriate support. So as I come in and the desire is to come in and link arms with them and say, hey, you don't know what you don't know. And in that profession and in most professions, when you're dealing with people, it's very difficult to be prepared for everything that's going to walk through your door. But being able to offer them this resource or this tool and say, you at least have the knowledge, and then you also have the ability to refer them out to good support, and you're going to be a hero because of that, right? Being able to offer them some good stuff. So,
absolutely. Well, I was going to ask you, what kind of response are you getting from pastors and church leaders, deacons, elders? What do they think about you coming in and wanting to share your information?
Well, it's interesting because the most common response I get in these conversations is, this is a huge need in our church. And the next thing they oftentimes will say is, I didn't realize there was a certain way to help her in this. And typically what I do is I affirm them and I say, it's true, and you aren't the only ones. Because I want all church leaders to understand that they aren't the only ones mishandling a marriage facing betrayal. It's across the board. Like, it's not just one particular person or place. But the thing is that our victory comes when each of us recognize the need and moves into the position of supporting. And so it's been very eye-opening for them to go, I really just always thought that I needed to take care of the addict. It didn't really cross my mind that she might need support. I thought if we got him better, she would be better. And I said, yes. That is a misunderstanding, but that is really definitely a consistent theme that I'm hearing as I get to talk with pastors in these roles. So
then what kinds of things do you tell them that they can do to help the partner?
Well, I really like to paint a picture of what a partner's reality looks like. And what I do is we can compare sexual betrayal hitting a marriage like a tragic house fire. And this is, you know, the couple's home. So just go with me on this, you know, this visual picture that this couple's home has been completely consumed by a fire and they were inside. They have managed to get to the edge of the property and suddenly help arrives, right? And this help in these situations looks like a meeting with a pastor, someone within our church, maybe they've gone to a counselor. And immediately, the way that this plays out is the husband is swept off to care, and he's offered support groups, accountability partners, other men to walk with, books to read, and people are advocating for his healing and health in some form or fashion, which I want to applaud the church in their efforts that they are making in this particular area. But meanwhile, she's been left behind at the destroyed home, injured, and she's not doing well. And the reality of it is that no one returns for her. So she slowly turns and she begins sifting through these ashes, the aftermath of this destructive fire. And she tends to you know, she tends to all the needs that come with this, right? As you can imagine, there's, you know, there's memories, there's hurt, there's pain, there's all these things that are happening for her around her in the aftermath of this destruction. So not only is she tending to the cleanup, she also is tending to the regular life. So she's handling the children, the house, anything that's, you know, life related. She's supporting him as he's seeking his own care. And, you know, the thing I say is, don't forget that she was in the fire when this whole thing came down, right? So she's bruised, she's bleeding in many places, and she's exhausted. But she continues to move around this devastation that she once understood as a safe place. And she's also waiting for his return, for him to be healed and better, so they can begin to rebuild this home. And for some marriages, the husband's returned from the hospital. Wounds are healed, fresh bandages and medicine. And he arrives on the scene of the fire, and his wife is still walking around trying to make sense of all this. And he's feeling better. And he's also confused by her limping and her weeping and her pain. And he's getting better, so why is she still struggling to stand? That's the kind of the confusion that you start to see happening in these marriages. And ultimately, what has been communicated to the woman in this kind of story is, if he gets better, then I'll get better. And remember, the ambulance came and took him. He had the hospital stay. He received the care he needed. She was left to wait for his return and hope he stops choosing his sexual sin over healthy life. And she does notice, you'll hear women say that, I knew that there was something wrong. She does notice the other wounds that she's carrying around, but she has other things to manage, care for, and carry. Plus, she's being told, let's get him help. He needs help. So she's unknowingly waiting for this to get better. And when a marriage comes before their church and discloses this information, the church has grown so much in the area of supporting the addict, like I mentioned before. And, you know, and I'm thankful for that. But however, if we go back to scripture and we talk about it, the Bible tells us that when a couple marries, it's two becoming one. So this tells us that there are two individuals in a marriage of one that need to be cared for. And we as a church are only caring for half the equation at this time. We're really forgetting to come back and help tend to her woundings as well.
Yeah, you know, it when you tell that kind of a story, it really does show the difference in how we treat somebody who's been injured via a fire versus injured via partner betrayal. And yet, truly, I can see where somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience would automatically go to that place and think, if I help him, I'll be helping the coupleship. And indeed, they are. But if they leave her out, you know, she ends up being wounded not just by him, but by the church as well, or the doctor,
right,
or the therapist, you know. And so I love that analogy. That really makes it clear why it's so important to help both.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
What can a pastor, well, let's just talk a little bit about the do's and the don'ts, because you have a whole list of do's and don'ts that make it very simple to identify when maybe we're doing the wrong thing.
Yeah. I do. I offer a do's and don'ts list, and I keep it simple and direct on purpose, because like I mentioned, our pastors, our clergy, they are bombarded with all sorts of needs and information every single day, just like in any other profession, right? And I think that, you know, just trying to be sensitive to that and recognize putting yourself in their position, but I want to offer them nuggets that they can recall in the moment when they encounter that couple or that partner for the first time or the 100th time. Because that's the other piece to this. I'll have pastors that will say to me, oh, man, I've had that couple in my office for 2 years, and she's just unforgiving, or she's bitter, and she just can't get past it. And I'm going, yeah, that's betrayal trauma. She's stuck in a place and not being able to move herself in. That woman needs healing, and she needs somebody to walk through that healing with her. And while he or she, whichever clergy is there, while they may not be the most ideal place, the power that they have in that seat, right, is that they are able to invite that person into healing and health and recovery. And so that's where I want to empower pastors as they're thinking about their congregation and the people that they're loving within their flock, that they would know that they can encourage this kind of help for them. But it's important for us to understand that, the do's and the don'ts, before we can start encouraging, right?
Absolutely. So then, again, your list of do's and don'ts just go into some simple explanations, like you call them, nuggets, that will help them to know if they're on the right track with the people that are sitting there in their office. So,
yes,
if you would you start with the don'ts? Because the don'ts are always something that can stay with us when we're thinking about how partners are treated.
Yes, for sure. Yes. So the do's and don'ts. We'll start with don'ts. Don't assume she recognizes that she needs support during this. Because what we see is many partners would tell you that the realization didn't come until more turmoil hit their family, and then she, quote unquote, buckled, right? So this could be from her personal pressure, a slip or a relapse from the addict, or a completely separate thing that pushes her over the edge. I've had sat with partners where the death of their mother, right, and that was the last straw. Like, she had been holding it together, and one of the visuals I use for women is like, it's like they're trying to hold a boat together that's just covered in holes. And, you know, eventually the one last hole just takes the whole thing down, right? And so don't assume that she recognizes the need for the support. The next don't is don't force a partner to quickly forgive. Don't force her into quick forgiveness, sorry, and allow her the space to grieve and work towards forgiveness. It's a process. And this is one of the biggest wounds I will hear from women as they start to enter into support with us, is saying, my pastor or this person, whoever it was, said that if I would just forgive, this would get better. And I'm struggling in that space. And it's because forgiveness is a process. The next one is don't ask about their sin issues from the onslaught of the addiction. This is really difficult, and I know that it's very tempting, but when you start to ask about the woman's sin issues, so for example, well, what did you do in response to this? Like, you start to dig into those spaces. This only causes additional shame and harm in the marriage. And they have enough that the devil is great at slathering shame on, right? And so it's something that needs to be addressed, but it's not in the very beginning. Partners do a fantastic job when they have the permission to start the healing process before they have to start looking in the mirror and figuring out their part. So don't ask them about their sin issues. The next one is don't ask about their sex life or their frequency as a couple. If you study any part of sexual addiction, you'll know that sexual activity and frequency with a person does not directly impact the choice to view porn. But this is a lie that, even in my own journey, I have seen spoken over women over and over and over again, is if you have sex with him, you will keep him from being tempted. And that is not true. It's not a truth there. This is their choice. Own their choice. And so asking them about their sex life just creates additional hurt and pain, as if she has responsibility in this.
So what would you suggest, that they just stay out of that topic at all?
No, I mean, I think that as the couple starts to heal, where you see that power come together, when you start to see the couple heal, then the conversation can come back. But we have to understand that these women have been betrayed on so many levels. From the person that they thought was the safest person in the whole world is now, it has become this distorted image. They don't know who they're with anymore. And so then you're asking them to go in and do something as vulnerable as have sex with them. It's really destructive. And even in my own story, like, I can vouch for that was a really destructive choice for us to do that, to rush back into that space thinking that it was going to fix something and even put a Band-Aid, and it didn't. It just caused more harm.
You're saying that because they talked to you about this, perhaps even recommended it, you two made the assumption that sex could fix things, and that did
Absolutely.
More harm than good. Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And so now, Lachelle, I'm going to ask you, just out of your own experience, we've got a lot of women who unfortunately feel so inferior. You know, they can't compete with a prostitute or with pornography or with a massage parlor that ends in a sexual favor. They can't compete. And so when they find out there's been that sexual betrayal, that's the first place they go. They think, well, maybe if I ramp it up, maybe it will keep him at home. What do you tell partners who mistakenly make that assumption?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you that I was one of those women. And the moment that I found out that this is what he was wrestling with, I thought, okay, if I can't beat him, I'll join him, right? And I really did attempt to lure. I thought somehow or another, I just wasn't keeping up. And if I could lure him away from, you know, this whatever, you know, temptation that he's experiencing. But the important thing for us to know about sexual addiction is that it's ultimately not about sex. It is about dysfunction with emotions. And so when you start to understand the premise of how this addiction was birthed for an addict, many times, here's the one thing that I know that has been said, and I know it to be true, is that I would say to my husband all the time, I don't understand why you're choosing them. And he would say, it's not about you. And that phrase confused me so much. I did not understand what he kept saying. I was like, how can this not be about me, right? How can it not be? And ultimately, as I started to understand sexual addiction in of itself, there's a way that they compartmentalize two different places, their reality versus unreality or non-reality, right? And so when he's going to that place of non-reality, he's looking for an emotional release, or actually he's avoiding his emotions. And so that release is what's happening. It's a coping mechanism. And I talk to women all the time. I go, it's no different. And I know I don't mean to cheapen this because I know there's so much pain in it, but it's no different than me going to my pantry and searching for Oreos. I've experienced some sort of emotional impact. I don't like it and I don't want to feel it anymore. So I will go find something to cope out with it. And what's happening with sex addiction is that behavior started at a very young age for addicts. And so it's still their choice. They're still choosing that as their coping mechanism when they step into that space. So,
well,
as
absolutely.
You can imagine,
and after a while, it isn't even a choice, because that behavior becomes so ingrained. It's automatic. It's almost like a habit disorder. It's compulsive until they get the right tools. So the good news is it's another indicator that it's not at all about the partner. This man's brain has gone haywire, and he is now addicted to whatever these behaviors are. And I'm just so glad that you were so honest as to share that you did the old, if you can't beat him, join him. That's a very normal response. And hearing somebody like you say, hey, I did that too, it really – well, I'm sure make partners feel better all over the world.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
So continue.
I mean, I guess that's the win, right? Learn from all of our mistakes.
Well, and that's the beauty of sharing information together. I mean, that's what this show is all about. It's to normalize, it's to educate, and it's to hopefully make you feel better about yourself, because partners are innocent bystanders. They're the casualty from sexual addiction. Uh-huh. They didn't cause it.
Amen.
They can't cure it. And you're helping pastors to figure out what they can do to support partners.
Yes. Yep.
All right. So continue with that list.
Okay. So then the final don't that we have on the list is don't rush her to heal. Because much like working with the addict, you're not able to push someone into recovery or healing. Our best efforts should be to walk alongside them and offer as much compassion as possible, even when we don't completely understand. And, you know, this kind of speaks to that, what the example I used earlier about the pastor saying, yeah, this lady's been in my office with her husband, and, like, he's doing all the right things, but she just can't get past it. And that is the indicator that she needs healing, right? She needs some space and permission to heal. And so being able to recognize that. And then also having the understanding that I can't rush her into this, because nothing's going to come from us rushing them.
Well, absolutely. So, as a matter of fact, we're taught that sex addicts require 3 to 5 years of healthy outer circle behaviors and sobriety before they have re-circuitized their brain so that neurocircuitry is healthy again. And unfortunately, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about this, Lachelle, I find the same thing for partners. They've been so traumatized. It is such an insult to who they are. It's such an injury to their relationship and their ability to trust themselves that after an addict gets sober, it oftentimes takes them 2, 3, 4, 5 years to really get their brain to go back online, to trust themselves, and to be able to see the relationship for what it is. And that's not their fault. That is a normal period of time that it takes.
Mm-hmm. I totally would agree with that, Carol. And then, of course, then I also think about the compounding, you know, compounding trauma, and that can come in with that too, because oftentimes for many of us, our stories don't just, this isn't the only trauma we've experienced. And so when you think about the history that you're bringing into this moment, it's like, it certainly is a slower journey than any of us would like for it to be, right? We all want to heal faster. But I would for sure say that 3 to 5 years, and when you can turn and look at him and go, I trust him. That's weird. I don't remember when we got here. And it's because it's a slow, steady journey.
Yeah, slow and steady. And here's the other thing that I really believe. You know, you were talking about compounding. And for our listening audience, they may not know exactly what that term means. And so just to share with our partners, that we do believe some women have post-traumatic stress or complex post-traumatic stress because they were molested in their own lives, or they experienced a lot of big T traumas like their parents' divorce and abandonment by their father and abuse, physical, verbal or sexual abuse. And when those kind of traumas occur early on, and then the person that has your back, the man that is supposed to protect you, betrays you, it can feel so overwhelming. And that's what you're talking about when you say compounding traumas, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so
you made
oftentimes
a real,
with partners... go ahead.
No, go ahead. Oftentimes partners.
Yeah, and so oftentimes what happens for partners is they start this healing process for themselves, more starts to come up, right? It's kind of like the image of an onion. Like you start peeling back the layers and you're like, oh my gosh, I need to heal in this space. And the beautiful thing about it is that a lot of times partners will find an amazing amount of freedom just by sitting in this space. It starts to have like this domino effect, and they start to get freedom from all these other places that were part of their history. So like, I remember in my own story, like working through abandonment issues, like that was one of the biggest fears in the very beginning of this that hit me, and recognizing that I had that issue even from things that had happened as a trauma in my childhood, and being able to spend time in that space and healing and recognizing the lies that I was believing, and, you know, understanding the fears that were, you know, really causing a lot of paralysis for me, like emotionally, started to give me freedom from even the abandonment issues that were happening in my childhood. So yeah, there's the work can be good in both places.
Well, and you made a really important comment when you said that, boy, thinking that it could take 2, 3, 4, 5 years to actually heal might feel overwhelming. And although that's one of the reasons we say, you know, do it a day at a time and stay in the moment and, you know, just put your foot forward and do it one step at a time. What we really know is that when you're working on yourself, and we at APSATS really believe that a lot of that work has to do with support and self-care. And when you're increasing your self-care and your support, time flies and you're learning new skills that you needed to have anyway. And so
it's actually a time to take care of yourself emotionally, physically, spiritually, intellectually, and relationally with other people that are safe.
Mm-hmm.
So, now we heard the don'ts. Give us the do's. What would you like for pastors and church leaders to do when they're working with a person?
So the do list. Do give her space to acknowledge the aftermath and the destruction. I mean, much like what you just said, Carol, you know, her entire reality just exploded in her face. Grief is a natural response that many pastors don't realize is needed or allowed. And so letting her be upset about this, it's you know, one of the authors I love, her book, she says, grief is the clotting system to healing. And so being able to experience the grief is going to naturally lead a person into healing. The next do is do allow her to be angry and to feel. Help her to know that anger is permissible and understandable. It's not a place we get to camp out in for 5 years, but it's a valuable emotion, and it helps us learn that there is something beneath it. And, you know, we talk a lot about that in support group, that anger is a secondary emotion. And so when you can start to answer the question, I'm angry because, and whatever comes in that after that because, that's the place that we get to do our work. Anger will keep us in a place of, you know, keeping us stuck. But being able to say, I'm angry because I feel betrayed, then we start working there. We start working on the feelings of feeling betrayed. So allow her to be angry and feel. The next
so if you allow her to be angry, if you allow her to be angry and you allow her to identify the because, that then mobilizes the person to use her anger to make changes that are healthy for her. And, you know, that's what I always say. I say anger is absolutely energizing as long as you do something with it that's positive, that's healthy. And so let's just, you and I go back and forth. You originally just said you got to give it a voice. You got to be able to identify why are you angry. So, again, you said I'm angry because, and if you were playing the partner, what would be one of the answers?
So I feel angry because I feel dismissed.
Oh, that's good.
I feel angry because
I don't feel good enough.
Mm-hmm.
You feel angry because?
I feel angry because I've been lied to.
Mm-hmm. And I feel angry because the man I thought had my back actually stabbed me in the back. And so when we come up with those kind of angers, then we can say, okay, what do we need to do? How can we feel safer? If you feel stabbed in the back, what can you do to make sure you're safe while he's getting through his recovery process and hopefully proving himself to you? Or you had said, I feel angry because I feel dismissed. So what would you suggest a woman do if she feels dismissed? How can she shift that?
Well, because my support system and the way that we do support is based on our belief system, there's a lot of this where I would sit with her and say, you know what? That is the truth for you. And we have a phrase we talk about, a little T and a big T, little truths and big truths. And so that is a little truth. She feels dismissed, right? That is true for her. But what is the big T truth, which a big T truth would be, what does the Word of God have to say about that? And then we go back and we start sitting in that space and going, have you been dismissed? Yes, I've been dismissed by my husband, and I can see that, but there's a part of this too where I need the knowledge to understand that the Lord has never dismissed me. He's never left me or forsaken me. I have been chosen over and over again. And so being able to sit in that kind of knowledge, I'm always very intentional to say to a woman, I'm not putting a spiritual Band-Aid on this. Like, this is the reality of what your belief system is saying to you. So being able to press back into the core of who you are, and understanding that you are not dismissed. this person has done an action that's dismissed you, and that has caused great pain for you. But being able to go back over here and go, actually, the bigger truth is, the big T truth is, I've never been dismissed. I've always been chosen.
Good. I'm sitting here thinking, obviously, you have a very strong spiritual background, and you have seen how that relationship with the higher power, with your God, has actually provided safety and clarity when traumatized. What about the woman that doesn't know if she believes in God? I'm thinking especially if they've had some compounding. You know, they have post-traumatic stress because their whole life has been pain. And they probably have said, where is God? Why isn't God protecting me? What would you say to that woman?
Yeah. You know, and that's, it's a big question that I get asked of a lot is why didn't he protect me from this? And I promise if I had an answer, I would be a bazillionaire, right? Because it's the question we ask in our faith, walk all the time. Why didn't he protect me from X, Y, and Z? And going back to the woman who doesn't really know if she can even trust God, that's exactly where I would start the conversation with her. Is going back into the betrayal that she's experienced that has created this distance from God for her. She needs to look at that too, because there's trust that has to be restored in that relationship. The opportunity to be able to share my own story with them and say, I assure you, there was a dysfunctional trust that was not happening in my story with the Lord either. And as I continue to cry out and say, I'm sorry, Lord, I don't trust you in this. I don't trust that you're going to take care of me. He continued to show up over and over again because he was so committed to letting that relationship be restored. And so being able to speak from my own personal story obviously offers them a little bit of hope, but I also know that God is willing to meet her in that space if she would just ask him. And I know that
sometimes what I even do is I will have her write out a letter to God talking about what feels like another layer of betrayal. And typically what happens in that letter is something goes from the conscious to the unconscious and then back to the conscious again. And they realize that if they had spiritual beliefs before, and if they felt like God should have been able to make this go away, or God should have been able to protect them from earlier trauma, when they write that letter, they become very, very clear about the fact that God's with them right now. They can feel God's presence right with them at that moment. And that shifts them. And instead of being angry, they realize God is a support again to them.
Yes. Isn't that amazing to watch that happen?
Yes, absolutely. It's fabulous.
Okay, so continue with the do's.
Okay, so we said give her space to acknowledge the aftermath, allow her to be angry and feel, allow her to grieve, and kind of already spoke to this, but just highlighting that again, allow her to grieve. She's lost everything and that she's understood to be her reality. She's experienced a tragedy, and grieving is essential to a partner's healing. I mean, you would never walk up to the edge of that fire line, right? Going back into the analogy or the picture of her, that house being burnt to the ground. You would never walk up to that line and go and say, what are you crying about? Right? Like, because you can see, visually see the devastation that's before her. You would never say to her, what are you crying about? So that's the other piece of this. It's like, or what are you sad about? What are you grieving? We would naturally allow that to happen. And so being able to let her do that, you know, that was one of the things that I didn't hear that. In my early days of recovery, no one said anything about grieving. And so what happens is that when we don't grieve, it will start to grow into a root of bitterness because we don't know what to do with it. I'm mad or I'm upset or I'm sad that he's made these choices and it's completely distorted our family. And if I don't let myself just be in that space and say I'm mad, sad, or upset, it just morphs into bitterness. And then I've got one more do. The last do is encourage her to seek support for herself and her processing. She needs someone who is qualified in this space to walk with her through the various levels of pain and trauma. And you know, there are professionals with the certifications of APSATS who are highly trained and skilled to support a partner and a couple really well. They know how to address this. And then in addition to therapists who are trained with a trauma specialty are another good option. And what I love about being in APSATS is that, and even what our ministry does, is being online and people being able to counsel online starts to break down those geographical barriers, which is such a gift for these partners to be able to know that there's help out there. And so, but the thing is like, this is where the pastor becomes empowered because now he has the knowledge of this certification that she probably has no clue exists. So being able to say, hey, I heard about this qualification. Let's see if we can find you somebody who can help you with this specialty.
Well, and you and I both know that one of the unique things about our organization is that we have coaches and therapists, and coaches can work around the world, helping clients to get to the resources that they need so badly. And so they may not be able to do therapy, but they are able to connect the partner with what she needs, the resources she needs. So, as a matter of fact, you're a coach.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes, I am a coach. And yes, it has been a true gift to be able to work with women and just continue to help them gain awareness and better clarity around what they're wanting and how they're healing and all the progress that they desire for themselves. It's a gift to be able to sit with them and do that. So yes.
Well, I can hear it in your voice and I can feel the passion, and I so appreciate that you have, you know, you showed resiliency to the point of you didn't allow this to destroy you. You felt the feelings. You had to go through the pain. You had to process, but you got stronger, and then you decided to give back. And so as we wrap up this show, Michelle, what would you tell our listening audience who primarily are partners? What would you tell them to inspire them to stay hopeful?
Oh, I would tell you that this is hard work, and we're not ignorant to that, right? We know, we understand that it's hard work, but I promise you that hard work is worth it. This healing journey, even for myself, has been able to open me up to healing in other areas, like I mentioned before, about other places of pain, given me such a life that feels so much fuller than it ever felt before. And I could not have told you that when I was in the middle of the valley and that mountain felt like it was ginormous. But what I often tell partners and I tell myself is it's one choice at a time. And so every choice we make to continue to do exactly what you said, Carol, about self-care, like when you start to get into that space and you're doing a good job of taking care of yourself, that 3-year journey doesn't feel like anything. It goes so much faster because you're starting to get joy back and you're starting to enjoy yourself and your life and all the things that come with this. But it doesn't come without doing the hard work first.
And, you know, that seems to be like life in general, is that there's always a lot of work that you have to put into your life. But when you work it, it does work. And what I know to be true about partners is that by far this is the worst betrayal that could occur. And so, of course, it's going to require a vast amount of work. And yet you turned it around and you were able to give back in a way that you probably never could have thought you would have been able to give it to the community of partners.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Michelle. You've been wonderful. And keep us posted on other projects. And how can they get a hold of you if they want more information about Hope Restored?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm even happy to send the list out if they want the do's and don'ts in writing. But they're welcome to anyone's welcome to contact me. You can check out our website, Hope with a hyphen in the middle, hope-redefined.com. Or you are welcome to email me at support@hope-redefined.com.
Okay, again, that's hope-redefined.com. And for anybody who's going through this in their church, they're able to get your do's and don'ts and take a look at them. And then if they just want to pass on this information to their ministers, pastors, priests, whatever, they can pop on your website, print them out, and take them in and say, I think this would really help the clergy here.
Yeah. Definitely.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. You're welcome, Carol. Thank you for having me today.
All right. Make it a good one.
I will. You too.
All right. That was Lachelle Burkett, and I'm telling you, this woman has a lot of knowledge on how to help pastors and how to help the church, the do's and don'ts of supporting a wife facing betrayal in her marriage. Again, you can go to Hope Redefined. And that's all we have for today. And of course, next week is Christmas. For any of my Christian listeners, I wish you a very Merry Christmas. And I know the holidays, they're rough. It's tough. But I promise you it will get better. You keep taking care of yourself. And we'll see you next time for more Betrayal Recovery Radio, because this show is all about recovery. We'll get through this together.
For more information, go to APSATS.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.